पाशनं हरे
अभाष ईशास्मित शोभया गिरा
अभाष ईशास्मित शोभया गिरा
व्यथ्याभिपैतं वचसा
कृतं
मया वो विभजे सुधामि माम्
कृतं मया वो विभजे सुधामि माम् ततो गृहीतामृतवाचनं हरे आभाषैषस्मित शोभया गिरा
यद्याद्वैतां वचसा सारु वा
Tata.
Thereafter.
Prihitva.
Taking possession of.
Amritabha Janam.
The pot containing the nectar.
Harihi.
The
Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, in the form of Mohini.
Babasa.
Spoke.
Ishat.
Slightly.
Smita
Shobhaya
Gira.
With smiling beauty and by words.
Yadi.
If. Abhupetam.
Promise to be accepted.
Kwacha.
Whatever it may be.
Sadhu Asaduva.
Whether honest or dishonest.
Kritam
Maya
is done by me.
Vaha,
unto you.
Vibhaje,
I shall give you the proper share.
Shudam,
nectar.
Imam,
this. So it's February 14, 2013, in Cape Town, South Africa. And this is Canto 8, Chapter 9, Text 13. And today I noticed there's all this red in hearts. I guess that's for Valentine's Day. But today is also Vasant Panchami, which in India is the first day of spring. Of course, it doesn't really make much sense here. It would be the first day of spring here. So today in India, all the deities are wearing yellow. So the deities are dressed in yellow. There's the whole temple is decorated with yellow flowers. All the people are wearing yellow. They all cook yellow food. They put haldi, turmeric in everything. And everything's yellow. Today is also Sarasvati Puja. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Thereafter, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, having taken possession of the container of nectar, smiled slightly and spoke in attractive words. She said, "My dear demons, if you accept whatever I may do, whether honest or dishonest, then I can take responsibility for dividing the nectar among you." Purport. The Supreme Personality of Godhead cannot abide by anyone's dictation. Whatever he does is absolute. The demons, of course, were deluded by the illusory potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and thus Mohini Murti got them to promise that whatever she would do, they would accept. Tato grihit vamrita bhajanam harir babasa ishat smita shobhaya gira yadya vipetyam kwa chasada sadhuva kritam mayavo vipache sudam imam. Thereafter, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, having taken possession of the container of nectar, smiled slightly and spoke in attractive words. She said, "My dear demons, if you accept whatever I may do, whether honest or dishonest, then I can take responsibility for dividing the nectar among you." So she got the nectar in the last verse. They gave her the nectar. And then she said, "I'm the one who's going to decide how it's divided, and you just need to accept whatever I say." So everybody wants nectar. Amritam. Amritam means death. This is Marchu Loka. Everybody here dies. We don't really believe that. And it's kind of hard to live like that. It's kind of hard to get up in the morning and say, I'm probably going to die today. Then you wouldn't go to work. You know, you wouldn't do anything. Right? Just be morose. So people go on living as if they're going to live forever. And none of us really believes that we're going to die. Of course, the reason we don't really believe that we're going to die is that we don't die. And that the fact that none of us actually believe we're going to die is very strong evidence of the fact that we're something different from this body. If we were just this body, if we were just the result of billions of genetic mutations over billions of years and coming from a bunch of chemical soup, we'd just be fine with the idea of death. It wouldn't bother us at all. But anyway, everybody wants life. Actually, everybody wants to live. Even the suicidal person actually wants to live. If you went to the suicidal person and said, "I'll fix all your problems," then they wouldn't want to kill themselves. They're just desperate, thinking the only way to get rid of their misery is to end their body. But what they want is a happy life. They don't want death. And we not only want to live, but we want a happy life. We want a vibrant life. This nectar, it not only makes you live for a long time. It's not like you're some 500-year-old person, you know, in a wheelchair with no teeth. But it gives you a strong, healthy body. You know, the demigods live, they're called immortal because they live for tens of thousands of years. And they don't get old. Or they get old very briefly. It's described that, you know, at the end of life, their garland fades, and then they know, okay, this is it. But it's very brief. Like also on the heavenly planets, childhood is very brief. Pregnancy is very brief. You know, basically, they're just living a long, youthful, vibrant, healthy life. So everyone wants that. Of course, even in the heavenly planets, that's not really fully what we want. Even there, you still have a material body, and there's still anxieties, even though you don't perspire and your clothes don't get dirty and so forth, and you don't have to walk on the surface of the earth, and you can fly to other planets. And... Thank you. Still, it's not perfectly what we want. What we perfectly want, of course, is total amrita in the spiritual world. We want a body that is spiritual. Right? Even on the highest planets, when the people there are born with all mystic powers, it's just natural, just like it's natural for us to walk. So the residents of that planet, it's natural for them. They can go from one planet to another and become smaller than the smallest and heavier than the heaviest and so forth. They have power over the material laws. But even that's not fully what we want. Anyway, everybody wants this amrita. Everybody wants nectar. Everybody wants life. So there, and they, when we work very hard to get it, you know, the demons and the demigods, they're both working very hard. In fact, it's really funny with these demons because they were pulling on the snake, right? And the demigods followed Vishnu to take the head. Remember that part? And the demons got the tail, but they weren't very happy. They thought, oh, you know, the demigods, they're more honored with the head. And when Lord Vishnu understood that, he switched and he walked over to the tail. And all the demigods followed him to the tail. And the demons were like, yes, we get the head. And they didn't realize that at the head, all this fire and smoke is coming out of Vasuki's mouth. So they're all covered with smoke. Right? And they were working really, really hard. And the mountain went into the ocean of milk. And then Kurma came. And I mean, it was a lot of hard labor and a lot of difficulty. Poison came out. Thought the whole world was going to be destroyed. And then all these other beings and creatures came out of the ocean, and they're fighting over them. Who's going to take, right? All this trouble. Finally, the nectar comes. This is basically material life. You know, you're working hard. Things don't work out quite the way you want. You first get a lot of poison. So many difficulties. And finally, oh, here's the fruit that I worked so hard for. You know, now I'm going to be deathless. So we're all trying to control being deathless and vibrant and healthy and strong and by our own endeavor, forgetting that Krishna is in control. And Prabhupada says here, he doesn't abide by anyone's dictation. Whether or not you get the results of your work is not dependent on how hard you work or how cleverly you work or anything like that. The demons here didn't work less hard or less cleverly than the demigods, right? But they got different results. And we see that in the world, in our everyday life. Two people do equal work, And one person succeeds and one person fails. Right? One person builds up everything and it's all destroyed. Their house burns down, their children go bad, whatever. And the other person is successful. Sometimes the person who works less is successful. Sometimes people do practically nothing and they're successful. And somebody else is, you know, working so hard and trying so hard and they fail. Like our rubber tires in our cars. The person who actually discovered rubber from the Amazon rubber trees and worked to make it, I forget his name, to make it usable. He died a pauper. And somebody else took his invention and became rich. So this kind of thing happens all the time. So therefore, the intelligent thing to do is to do what Mohini is telling the demons here to do. Surrender. Accept whatever I'm going to do. Sadhu, asadhu. Whether it appears to be honest or dishonest. From our perspective, if I work hard, I should get a good result. And if I'm lazy, I should not get a good result. Of course, we're only seeing one life. We're not seeing the whole picture. And we're saying, you know, that this should lead to this, and this should lead to this. We see the world as quite unfair because it doesn't go according to our dictation. The Supreme Lord cannot abide by anyone's dictation. He's doing what he wants. And then Prabhupada says next is whatever he does is absolute. Somebody might think, well, Krishna is doing whatever he wants, so he's whimsical. The view of the demigods is usually like that. Cultures that worship the demigods, like the old Greek and Roman and the Norse traditions, and there's still many traditions on the planet today that worship demigods. And they generally see them as very whimsical. Well, I like you, you know, you worship me, I'll give you what you want. You didn't worship me, I won't give you what you want. Right? You know, the stories of the different demigods. But Krishna's not like that. Although nobody can tell him what to do, everything he does is absolutely perfect. Our experience of dictators, no one can, Supreme Personality of God, he cannot abide by anyone's dictation. He's the ultimate dictator. And our experience of worldly dictators is very negative. Right? Absolute power corrupts absolutely. That we see that whenever anybody is in such a position that they don't have to listen to anybody, they act selfishly, and they act whimsically. They act out of fear, they act out of envy. But here Krishna, he doesn't have to listen to anybody, and he can control everything. He can say, you both worked hard, but you get it and you don't. Why? Because Krishna knew that the demons shouldn't have this amrita. Just like, you know, there are laws in most countries who can buy a weapon, right? I mean, in America, we're not very good about this, but we have these laws in every state. Who can buy a weapon? There's supposed to be a check. It's not just because you have money that you can buy a weapon. You can't say, well, I worked hard. I earned the money. You know, I should be able to have a gun. Anybody should be able to have a gun if they work for it. The answer is no. It's not just whether or not you work for it. It's how you're going to use it, whether or not you deserve it. So Krishna is saying not just, you know, what do you do, but what's your mentality? What are you going to do with it? If you give the demons such power, then they're going to misuse it. And the whole universe, thank you, the whole universe is going to be put into chaos. Now sometimes the demons do get power. Sometimes they do so much good karma because there's laws in the universe. So basically, if you follow the laws, you do get power, even if you're evil. Which is why evil people get power. But sometimes Krishna interferes. Now, it's interesting here, the way he's interfering is not by force. Krishna doesn't interfere by force. Rarely. I can't think of any example off the top of my head at all. But he interferes by respecting his own laws of the universe and respecting free will. So he's saying to the demons, hey, can I have that pot of nectar? And are you okay? Are you okay with my doing whatever I want with it? Is that okay with you? He doesn't just take it. Because after all, they did earn it. So generally, Krishna respects the laws of the universe. Actually, that's one of the qualities of Krishna given in the nectar devotion, that he's dependable. And even the demons know, if we follow the rules, Krishna won't mess with us. You know, but sometimes, just like Hiranyakashipu, he got all this power by following the universal laws. But he was so misusing his power. So without messing with the universal laws, Krishna stopped him. Krishna sent this great devotee to be his son, knowing that Hiranyakashipu would attack and abuse his son. And then Krishna can come. That's part of his standard, that he can come to protect his devotees. So without breaking any of the codes, without breaking any of the promises of Lord Brahma, he killed Hiranyakashipu. And even though he had worked for what he had, and even though by his work he would have enjoyed what he had for much longer, because he violated other universal rules, don't offend the Vaishnavas, therefore that rule superseded the others. So generally when Vishnu interferes like that, when Krishna interferes like that, he does so even according to the rules. He doesn't have to, but generally he does. I mean, if he didn't, then nobody would have any respect for the universal rules. If you knew that whatever I did, that, you know, God's just going to come in and tweak it all without asking me, then nobody would be pious. And then nobody could make progress. But Krishna does try to work in such a way that evil people who earn the right to power don't get to have it very long. Because although he wants to respect the universal rules, the universal rules are ultimately there for the good of all the population of the universe. So he doesn't really want evil people taking advantage of the universal rules to cause havoc. He's interested in the spirit of the law, not just the letter of the law. And so while he generally, almost always, keeps to the letter of the law, he is able to manipulate things in such a way that the spirit of the law is kept. And so that's what he's doing here. Yes, you worked for everything, but now because you've given me permission to do what I want, I'm going to do what I want and give the nectar to those who deserve it. I'm going to give the nectar to those who want peace and prosperity. The demigods are demigods because they're relatively freed from lust, anger, envy, greed, and illusion. They're not 100% free, but relatively free. And they're generally, again, not absolutely, but they're generally submissive to the rule of the Lord and the will of the Lord, and they generally, again, not always, but generally they work for the benefit of all living beings in the universe. Generally they manage the universe for the good of all living beings. I mean, we don't see something like this very much in our present, on the planet at the present time, governments who really work for the good of the people. You know, the governments today are corrupt, more corrupt, most corrupt, absolutely corrupt, you know. That's basically, and if you're in a country where the government is absolutely corrupt and you go to a country where it's just more corrupt, you're like, oh, what a nice government. So we don't have much vision of this. I mean, even in our modern society, it's becoming so that, to find parents who really work for the good of the children, husbands who really work for the good of the wife, right? Company presidents who really work for the good of the employees, it's becoming rarer and rarer and rarer, which is why in our modern society, there's all this rights talk. You know, children's rights and women's rights and citizens' rights and labor rights. Why? You wouldn't need to have any talk like that at all if the people in authority were acting according to the will of God. It just wouldn't be necessary. If the governments were actually benevolent and righteous, then they would make sure that everybody in the country, that the business people were also righteous, and they would make sure that the men took care of the women and the adults took care of the children and etc. And the cows were taken care of and the Brahmins were taken care of and so forth and so on. So it may be hard for us to understand because we don't have so much practical experience of benevolent government. But in the universe there is benevolent government, and Krishna wants the nectar to go to them. That's his mood. That's his desire, because he cares. He's not interested in just the rules for the sake of the rules. He's interested in the rules for the sake of happiness. So the demigods trust Krishna. Now, in this case, the demons also trust Krishna, but not for very long. And it's quite interesting, because the demons do trust Krishna here for a few moments. For a few moments. But they don't really trust Krishna because they trust Krishna. They're thinking that if I let this incredibly attractive woman, most attractive woman, who can be a more attractive woman than Krishna, who comes as a woman? So if I trust this incredibly attractive, unattached woman, then she'll enjoy with me. She'll pick me. And I'll get something. So they're hoping for something. Actually, all material world is like that. All conditioned souls are saying, I have something that you want. And do what I want, and I might give you what you want. I might. Right? And sometimes the carrot keeps advancing. Right? So pretty much all materialistic relationships are like that. You know, I have something that you want. You really want it, don't you? Okay, well, just do this and you can have it. So that's the game that she's playing with them, and they're used to that game. That's the game they play all the time. And so they go along with it. But they're not really trusting her. They're not really surrendering. They're bargaining. They're keeping their demoniac mentality. You know, and they're convinced that she has something so incredibly wonderful that they want that they're willing to make a very irrational bargain. Because they just work so hard for this nectar. You know, they really worked hard for this nectar, and if they got this nectar, it would give them a lot of what they believe they want. And they're willing to risk it because they think, well, I'm going to get something better here. You know, of course they're not. They're going to end up with nothing. And this is the nature of all material lust, that we think, you know, I'm willing to risk my reputation, my money, my whatever, for this thing. I mean, that's not just sexual lust, but any kind of course, sexual lust is one of the, how shall we say, most devastating, that people have sacrificed empires for sexual lust. Pretty amazing, you know. You hear about these sports heroes, they're making billions of dollars, they're famous all over the world, you know, their pictures are up in all the airports as the epitome of the perfect person, and, you know, wonderful family, everything, and they throw it all away for sexual lust. Amazing. You know, or some big politician, like we had our former President Clinton who did that. So you're the President of the United States, you're President of the most powerful country in the world. And just, you know, for lust you throw it away. But people will do that also for money, not just for sex. They'll do it for money, they'll do it for power, and they'll do it for all kinds of things. And they'll throw away everything that they have. They'll gamble everything that they have, hoping that they won't get caught. So the demons are doing a very similar thing here, and of course they lose. But the devotees' trust in Krishna is quite different. So this is, of course, the last prayer of the Shikshastika. You can embrace me, you can trample me. Sadhu asadhu, you can do whatever you want. I trust you. And that's actual trust. We're not making a deal with Krishna. Or maybe we are, in which case we still have some demoniac mentality in our heart. So, you know, when we go to Krishna and we say, Krishna, I trust you. Like I was saying last night, Sarvadharman Prichaja, Mam Ekam Sharanam Vraja, Mam Ekam Sharanam Vraja, I surrender to you. You can do with me whatever you like. Marobi Rakobi, Jivane Marane. You can protect me, you can kill me, you can give me prosperity, you can give me poverty, you can embarrass me. Just reading how Rupa Goswami, actually it was Jiva Goswami, I can't remember, was Rupa Goswami or was the commentary of Jiva or Vishwanath, I can't remember. They were explaining that the living entities who are attracted to Krishna in conjugal love but become queens in Dwarka instead of gopis in Vrindavan, part of the reason is they don't want to be embarrassed. They don't want to be defamed. They're not willing to be defamed. That somebody will say, oh, you know, why are they running off with Krishna when they're not married to him? They have some attachment to honor, to doing something honorable. That's the whole idea of Vaidhi Bhakti, one's attached to some opulence, some honor, just the rules. Right? But in the last prayer of the Shikshastika, which is in the mood of Radharani, she's saying, doesn't matter. And you're a lumpataha, you're a debauchee. But still, whatever you want to do. And we see this also with great devotees like Bhishma. Bhishma, who was willing to fight on the wrong side. Now, part of that was something very rasika, that he has this chivalrous rasa with Krishna, and so he's enjoying, and he can't fight with Krishna if he's on the same side. So, you know, Bhishma sees the face of the Lord, and Arjuna just sees Krishna's back on the chariot. Arjuna's not fighting with Krishna, he's fighting on the same side. So part of the reason Bhishma was on the wrong side was to have this rasa with Krishna. But another reason he was on the wrong side was to show that no matter who you are, if you're on the side of your religion, you're going to lose. You can be the most powerful person. So the devotee agreed to do that. Just like in a drama, somebody has to play the bad guy. I used to be in the Ramayana, and there was this really nice, mellow brahmachari, Lokamangala, who would play Ravana. You know, and the Ravana persona was like the opposite to his own persona. But somebody had to play Ravana, and he was a very good actor, very convincing Ravana. So somebody has to play that part, and sometimes it's a devotee. Sometimes a devotee says, okay, I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to be criticized. Oh, that he fought for Duryodhana. But there's a lesson there. The devotee is teaching a lesson to everybody in general. When Yudhisthira, I mean, who gambles away their wife? Even you go to the big gambling Monte Carlo and Las Vegas, you know, nobody's gambling away their wife. And to their enemy. Gambling away your wife to your lifetime enemy. Gambling away your brothers. We were at a college in Durban, and there was a sign, be careful you don't become a victim of human trafficking. It's like, whoa. I've never seen something like that anywhere in the world. Don't become a victim of human trafficking. Interesting that although slavery is illegal, I believe it's illegal everywhere in the world. I don't think there's any place in the world where slavery is legal. Well, maybe I'm wrong. But still, it goes on illegally. But basically, Yudhisthira was gambling away his brothers and his wife as slaves. Who would do that? Who would do that? Just to try to get the kingdom back? Let the kingdom go. You know, he became so maddened by gambling. This is the madness of the gambler. So why did he do that? He's Dharmaraj. He doesn't even think anything irreligious. Why did he do that? Because he's willing as the devotee. Krishna, you can use me as you like. And Krishna wanted to set an example, don't gamble. So if someone says, oh, I can gamble. One of our leading devotees, his son is a professional gambler. And what's really funny is that his son has the same legal name as he does. So this devotee was telling me if somebody does an internet search for his name, they'll find his son's name, you know, top poker player. Anyway, the devotee was telling me that his son said to him, well, Dad, it's not really gambling because I know what I'm doing. It's work, for it's my job. So if anybody says, oh, I know what I'm doing with gambling, I can play with it. Yeah? And he'd say, what about Yudhisthira? He's Dharmaraj. Look what happened to him. Such an extreme example. So nobody can say, oh, I'm immune. Anyway, my point is the devotee is willing, whatever you want me to do, Krishna. If you want me to preach in a hellish planet, you know, Haridas Thakur, you want me to take birth as a Muslim and get beaten in 23 marketplaces for chanting. You want me to be the son of Hiranyakashipu and have him throw me off a cliff and throw me in boiling oil. You know, the demon's mood here is, sure, we'll give you the nectar because we know you're going to give it back. There was a bargain. It was very conditional. Because as soon as Mohini actually didn't give them the nectar, there was a war. So how did the devotees behave? You know, are we bargaining with Krishna or are we surrendering to Krishna? Are we saying, Krishna, I surrender to you. Okay, but I want this and this and this, and I want it like this and 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 like this. And as soon as Krishna doesn't make it like this and like this and like this and like this and like this, then do we have a war? Oh, Krishna, I'm not going to serve you anymore. I don't, you know. What is this Krishna consciousness? But to have this faith that whatever he does is absolute. Even what Krishna does for the demons is good for them. Why doesn't he want the demons to have nectar? It's not just for all the other living entities in the universe, it's for them too. You know, if an unrighteous person gets power, not only are they going to hurt others, they're going to start amassing really bad karma, they're going to hurt themselves. They can end up suffering so much for all the terrible things they do with that power. You don't give, you know, some power tool to a two-year-old. Not only may they, you know, cut up the house and burn down the house, but they may cut off their own hand. So it's actually loving on Krishna's part. Everything's loving on Krishna's part. Even, you know, it's fighting with the demons, even when he kills somebody. I mean, ultimately, you could say Krishna kills everybody. But it's all love. Krishna doesn't, he doesn't have any envy in him. He has loving anger, but he doesn't have envy. Why should he envy anybody? Krishna has everything. He is everything. He is the greatest. He has no reason to envy anybody. Not only does he not have a logical reason to envy anybody, he just simply doesn't. One of the liberations is you can have equal opulence with the Lord. You can have an equal form with the Lord, live on the planet with the Lord, equal opulences. You know, no conditioned soul will do that. No conditioned soul will say, let all my neighbors have equal opulences to me. Let all the women in the neighborhood have clothes as nice as mine. You know, this is not going to happen. Many years ago, one of my students gave me this beautiful chatter. His family was from Nepal, and he said, oh, my mother has sent this from Nepal. It was really, really beautiful. Many different colors, and I said, wear it to the temple in the morning. So I wore it to the temple, and I looked around, and guess what I saw? All the women in the temple had the same chatter. His mother had bought chatters like that for everybody. And I was so disturbed, and I'm like, what? Why am I disturbed? Like, I thought, my God, I'm envious. I want to have something better than everybody. It was so shocking to me that I was envious. And that I want to have something better than everybody else. So Krishna is not envious. Krishna is more than happy to give, practically speaking, equal power and opulence to any jiva. And when he removes something from a jiva, it's not out of envy. It's out of love. So do we really accept Krishna as supreme? You know, it's interesting how when we first come to Krishna consciousness, we say, I've surrendered. I remember being at one of our Guru's Vyas Puja ceremony, and this one girl just recently come to Krishna consciousness, and she was reading some offering and saying, and you know, I feel so wonderful when I surrender everything to Krishna. And I thought, right. But, you know, do we really surrender everything? And one test of whether or not we surrender everything is what do we do when Krishna gives the nectar to somebody else? You know, what do we do when we think he hasn't held up his part of the bargain? And then we realize we haven't surrendered at all. We've made a bargain. You know, surrendering, there's no bargaining. Like Prahlad Maharaj said, this is not a merchant exchange. Now, then you might say, well, that's not very fair. I give everything to Krishna, totally, and he can just do whatever he likes, and I just have to take it. Wow, that doesn't sound very good. You can see why we don't do it. That's where the mind goes, isn't it? It's like, whoa. But actually, Krishna does give one everything in return. Krishna gives himself. Prabhupada says, Krishna is held in the hand of the devotee. That's why pure Krishna consciousness is so rarely achieved, one of the reasons. Because then Krishna becomes controlled, but he allows the devotee to control him. Because the devotee has love. So the demons want to control Krishna also, but they want to control Krishna for their own nefarious purposes, and Krishna just doesn't agree. Even we don't agree to that, do we? At least not knowingly. not voluntarily. We don't agree to let some evil person control us. I mean, sometimes it happens, but that's not our preference. So why should Krishna agree? So the devotee gets back billions of times more than they give. What can I give? I'm a very little jiva. How, you know, even if I surrender everything to Krishna and I think, well, I've really given Krishna a lot, you know, what do I have? What do I have? I mean, the only thing I really have is my own will. My body already belonged to Krishna. My mind already belonged to Krishna. All my, you know, my clothes, my bag, my glasses case, my recording device. It's all Krishna's anyway. You know how you know it's Krishna's? Because he can take it away whenever he wants. And he doesn't even have to give you notice. Well, then you know it must belong to him, right? Correct? That's how you know who has ownership. So I'm giving all that. Krishna, I'm giving you my body. It was already mine. I'm giving you my mind. It was already mine. I'm giving you all my possessions. They were already mine. You have something else? So as Prabhupada says in, I think it's 1515. Can't remember. Where Prabhupada says one should know what is one's own, what is actually one's own and what is not one's own. So what's ours? The only thing that's mine is my free will. That's mine. So I give that to Krishna. But what's that worth? It's not worth a whole lot. I'm just a tiny little, I'm so insignificant. You know, as soon as the airplane goes up a little bit, all the people disappear. Right? Just a little bit. I mean, just you can see the cars. The cars are only like this small. People are just gone. So insignificant. I want to speak of the whole planet's insignificant, for goodness sakes. Speak about me, I'm very insignificant. You know, it's always interesting when someone gives the introduction to the speaker and they capsulize. So I'm almost 58, so I'm like 57 and a half years, and they encapsulate it in 1 minute. Everything I've done is boiled down, you know, or sometimes it's just like 20 seconds. Oh, everything I've done, everything I am, just kind of, that's it. You know, one devotee I know recently left his body, and devotees are just, they're writing little, you know, three sentences. Right? So how significant am I that I'm giving Krishna something so wonderful when I surrender? Right? He really owes me. You know, now he should do everything nice for me because I've given him something so valuable. But Krishna actually gives himself, and Krishna's unlimited. So the jiva gives this little teeny, teeny, tiny little, here's my will, Krishna. And then Krishna gives back himself, and Krishna gives the jiva then full freedom. So Krishna gives back a gazillion, unlimited times more, whatever we can give. But still we don't want to give that little tiny bit. You know, we just don't want to give. We want to have the guarantee first. You know, we want to see the contract first. Let me see the contract. If I give, what will I get? And we're like giving, you know, and kind of holding on to it. Here, Krishna, I surrender. Yeah. Right? So that's exactly what the demons are doing. That's exactly what they're doing. They're saying, yes, you can do whatever you want, but you better do this. And if you don't do this, then forget about all the surrender. They're not really in love with Mohini. They just simply want to exploit. They're seeing Mohini as somebody to exploit. They're not giving their heart. So how foolish, because then they end up really with nothing. They end up with nothing. They don't get to enjoy Mohini, and they don't get to drink the nectar, and they don't get the power, and they don't get, right? They lose the war. And the devotees get everything. So at a certain point, our faith becomes strong enough that we actually surrender. And then when we actually surrender, we say, well, why did I wait so long? Why was I so hesitant to surrender to Krishna? So questions, comments, additions, subtractions, chastisements. Was the time okay? I wasn't sure when I should end. Is this the proper time? Did I go too long? What time does class usually end? Now? 9 o'clock. Oh, so I'm early. I was worried that it was 8:30 and I was going way over time. So any questions or comments? Thoughts? Yes?
I'm just thinking about the surrendering. Obviously, like you said, you know, we don't want to do it. So how do we go about doing it so that eventually we get to the funky Krishna conversation?
Well, first it's hearing. And hearing and hearing and hearing and hearing and hearing and hearing and hearing. That helps wear down our resistance. And then associating with people who are more surrendered than we are and seeing that they're happy. So, there's one devotee I know who went through, for good reason we could say, but who went through a lot of difficulty and especially was publicly maligned and criticized and had really so many things. I hesitate to say everything because it's very rare that somebody has everything taken away. Everything taken away would mean you were a quadriplegic and you were in the street living out of a garbage can and you had no friends. And so that doesn't happen very often to anybody. But he had very many things taken away. And he had, what he lost was a lot of the things that I felt for myself were really important to me. You know, what this devotee lost were things that are some of my strong attachments. And I saw that this devotee was very happy. Not only is he happy, but his life basically goes on. It didn't really affect anything on a deep level at all. So you associate with people who are more surrendered, and you see that they're happy. And they're okay. And that gives you a lot of faith. You say that, you know, even if these terrible things happen, it's still okay. You know, and I made a little mantra for myself. It's all going to be okay, and if it's not okay, it's still going to be okay. You know, that even when the terrible things happen, there's nothing really terrible that happens. You know, when I was reading this verse over last night, I was thinking, nothing bad ever happens to anybody. What to speak of to the devotees who are surrendered, but really nothing bad ever happens to anybody. That's from our very limited perspective. Now, I understand, you know, if somebody's cutting your arm off, then it's pretty hard to say, nothing bad is happening to me. Somebody's cutting off your family's heads in your presence and, you know, raping your mother in front of you and burning down your house and cutting your hands off. I mean, that kind of thing happens to people. It's not like it ever happens to anyone. Not that many miles away from here, that kind of stuff is happening right now as we speak to somebody. You know, and if we were go to those people and say, everything's good, you know, they'd probably punch us. But it's a fact that everything's good. It's a fact that everything that happens is perfect. So to get that faith that everything that happens is perfect, that even the most horrific, horrible, painful things, you know, that none of us would want to happen, still they're all perfect. And they're all ultimately loving. I mean, on another level, none of them in the material world is really happening at all. This world is compared to a dream. It's happening on one level, but it's not happening to us. So that's another way you realize, just like if somebody's playing a computer game and their character in the computer game gets their arms cut off and gets killed, it's not happening to the person sitting in the chair. Now, if you're really attached, it may be devastating. Oh, my character's dead. My character got his arms cut off. That's what it is. This world is like a big, you know, computer simulation, or movie, or dream that we're identifying with. So when the character in the movie is suffering, and by just like people watch movies, and when they watch the movies, they're also crying, right? Why are they crying? Just three colored lights on the screen. I'm crying for three lights. And even if you want to say, you know, beyond the lights, then it's just some actors. Nobody's really getting their, you know, whatever terrible things happen. It's a bunch of actors. Why are we crying? But because we want to enjoy the illusion, that's why people go to the movies. They don't go to the movies just to think, oh, it's just a couple wipes. They go there to be an illusion. That's the purpose. Want to be an illusion.
So we think this world, which is just a combination of goodness, passion, and ignorance, red, yellow, and blue, it's all it is. Just a dancing of protons, neutrons, and electrons. And we go, I'm enjoying, I'm suffering. So whatever bad thing Krishna does to us, first of all, it's not bad. It's loving. What to speak of for his devotees. That's true even for the demons, it's loving. Because Krishna loves everybody equally. He doesn't envy anybody, as he says in the Bhagavad Gita. But especially for the devotees, Krishna never does anything harmful for the devotees. It's always loving. And anyway, whatever's happening to us in this world that we think is bad or good, it's all. That's all. It's not really happening to me at all. And if I really surrender to Krishna, I'll realize that. I'll be living on a different platform. I won't be living on the platform of this world. It's explained in the Bhagavatam that for the self-realized soul, they're hardly even aware that they have a body. Like an intoxicated person is hardly aware if they're dressed or not. They're hardly even aware of it. They're not feeling the material pains and pleasures. So we say, okay, first have me experience that and then I'll surrender. It doesn't work like that. That's not surrender. That's bargaining again. Krishna, first give me unlimited ecstasy. First have me realize I'm not this body. First let me be above the material pains and pleasures. First let me see that everything you see is good. First let me have this transcendental vision and then I'll surrender. No, you get all that when you surrender. Otherwise, it's not surrender. It's something else. It's not love. And then little surrenders, they help. Of course, Bhaktisiddhanta, this is one heavy. I said, but Bhaktisiddhanta, it was funny. He says partial surrender isn't surrender. But putting that aside for the moment, I only bring that up in the name of honesty. I don't want to bring that up. I don't want to bring up that quote, but I thought, well, really, to be honest, I have to bring up that quote. But our little surrender, even though a little surrender is not real surrender, but it's still something. Surrender something, and you find that you gain more than you lose. Haven't you found that? Yes. I remember a few years ago, I was giving a class, and some people who were very new to Krishna consciousness asked the perennial question of those who are new to Krishna consciousness, what do I do about my non-devotee friends and family? If I become a devotee, what will happen to all my relationships with these people? And at some point at that class, I realized, because my general reaction to that question is internally, I probably shouldn't say this, it's being recorded, but internally my reaction is, what a silly concern. What a petty concern. Although externally I try to be kind. And somehow that day, I remembered that there was a time when, for me, it wasn't a petty concern. There was a time when that was a major concern for me, too, when I said, what about my friends? What about all my friends who aren't devotees? What will happen to all these friendships that I had for so many years, all these people? And I realized in giving that class, you know, these things happen very fast, that it was just gone. It was just gone. That it had been a huge problem and a huge block. How can I surrender to Krishna? The problem was gone. It was just non-issue for me. A complete non-issue. So that helped me get more empathy for the people who were having that issue at the present time. But it also really highlighted that anything we're hesitating about, once we surrender it, becomes nothing. So that also gives you some faith. That the things I'm hesitating about now, they're going to be non-issues as soon as I surrender. And everything will become a non-issue when I fully surrender. And once you surrender something, then immediately you think, why did I wait so long? And someone just recently in Durban was talking to me about some attachment that he has. It's so hard to give it up. And I said, no, giving it up is not hard at all. Preparing to give it up is hard. Getting the courage to give it up is hard. Giving it up is actually easy. The act of giving it up, the act of surrender is extremely easy. It's extremely easy, it's extremely fast, and it's extremely joyous. Haven't you experienced it? Yes? Have we all experienced that? But the actual act of letting go of some attachment and the actual act of surrendering something to Krishna is a very easy, natural